Tonight on Arena, Lloyd Grossman on his long love affair with the Eternal City, and Cormoran and Robin are back on our TV screens with a new series of Strike. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. He's known to many of us through his writings and broadcasts on food, but Lloyd Grossman has always had an interest in arts, heritage and culture. His latest publication, An Elephant in Rome, Bernini, the Pope and the Making of the Eternal City, documents how Gian Lorenzo Bernini reimagined Rome during the Counter-Reformation. And Lloyd Grossman joins me now. Bring me back, if you would, Lloyd, to the moment when you saw the elephant in Rome that actually is at the very centre of this entire book.
Yeah, Sean. Well, it was kind of a very odd moment for me because I was a student and I'd been interrailing around Europe. I arrived in Rome and I was having a little wander around. I went through a small square called Piazza della Minerva just behind the Pantheon, which, of course, is one of the great tourist attractions. And in this small square in front of a very beautiful church was a statue. And it wasn't a statue of a Roman emperor. It wasn't a statue of a god. It wasn't a statue of a saint. It was a statue of an elephant. And it was dedicated to Pope Alexander VII. And at that moment, I had quite a few conflicting thoughts. I thought, gosh, this is really weird and strange. Gosh, this is actually rather beautiful and inspiring. And perhaps most importantly, I just said to myself, what the heck is a statue of an elephant got to do with Pope Alexander VII? And why is it here in the middle of a Roman square? That sent me on a very, very, very long voyage of discovery in which I began to learn a really tremendous and exciting amount of stuff about 17th century Rome, about the way the papacy worked, and most importantly, about Gian Lorenzo Bernini, who in the same century as Rembrandt and Vermeer and Velázquez was by far the most famous artist in Europe. So it was really an extraordinary trip that I went on based on this statue.
Now, you describe it as a statue of an elephant, which in itself is unusual enough, but it's an elephant with an obelisk on its back. So you might, an obelisk being, I suppose, an ancient Egyptian monument fundamentally, but how is that making its way into this Roman mix?
Well, the whole thing about obelisk is really kind of amazing because, you know, after Julius Caesar was assassinated, ancient Roman politics were rather complicated. His heir apparent was his nephew Octavian, who most people know better as the Emperor Augustus. Augustus's biggest move probably was conquering Egypt and making it a Roman province. Now, this was very, very important. First, because Egypt was a great source of grain, and someone had to provide enough grain to feed the population of Rome. And secondly, because Egypt meant that you could control of Egypt meant that you could control the Eastern Mediterranean. Augustus was so excited about conquering Egypt, which, of course, was at that stage the world's longest enduring civilization. He wanted to celebrate his conquest of Egypt, and he decided to do it by bringing back the ultimate souvenir. And the ultimate souvenir was not, I went to Cairo and bought this crummy t-shirt. The ultimate souvenir was bringing back an actual piece of ancient Egyptian civilization, an obelisk. Now, these obelisks, you know, some of them weigh 200, 250 tons. And the idea of dismantling it, loading it on a ship, getting it across the Mediterranean, and getting it to Rome and re-erecting it was in itself a testimony to how powerful and skillful the ancient Romans were. So they began to come to Rome as souvenirs.
So it was really a way of the emperors at that time saying, number one, we're ahead of Egypt. We forget about that ancient old civilization. Look at us and look at how powerful we are. So bring us then into 17th century Italy. Is there a parallel type of statement being made by those who are, because there were obelisks there, but they'd kind of fallen into disrepair, my understanding is from the book. Were people at that in the 17th century, who were the people making the statement of, look at me and look what I can do with the elephant and the obelisk?
Well, they were really the popes. I mean, what was very interesting is that ancient Rome had a lot of obelisks. And of course, after the fall of the Roman Empire, the obelisks themselves began falling over and getting buried and so on. And it was in the 16th century that a great pope with the rather comical name of Pope Sixtus V decided that he would start moving obelisks around and that he would plant them in prominent places in Rome, which would then serve as signposts for pilgrimage and the thousands, tens of thousands of pilgrims who came to Rome during the holy years. So the obelisks were re-erected as a way of guiding pilgrims around Rome. And rather interestingly, because obelisks were pagan monuments, they had to be exorcised. So they would be exorcised. The bad spirits of ancient paganism would be taken away from them. They would be topped with crosses and turned into Christian monuments to inspire the pilgrims as they made their way around the seven basilicas of Rome. This use of obelisks increased in the 17th century when the papacy was a little bit on the ropes because the popes were losing political power. Along came the wonderful Pope Alexander VII, and he thought, gosh, how can I enhance the status of the papacy? I know, I'm going to make Rome the most beautiful city in the world. I'm going to make it the indispensable tourist attraction. And he did it through the use of obelisks, through Baroque architecture, and a great patronage of art and architecture in general.
But are we also looking here at a situation where you spoke about how in some ways this was the, I suppose, the Christianity or taking over the pagan monuments that the obelisks were initially. But to what extent we're in counter-reformation Europe at this point in time, and we're talking about the papacy doing this. Was it some sort of statement back at those who had reformed the church, you know, and the Protestant faith? Was there some kind of statement being made there?
Oh, totally, because following, you know, the earliest phases of the Reformation, the church decided, you know, they convened this great meeting of senior clerics known as the Council of Trent. And one of the things the Council of Trent came up with is the fact that art and architecture could be used as a way of bringing people back to the faith. It could be used as a way of inspiring people. And this caused a tremendous growth in the decorative arts and the fine arts in Rome. And of course, the popes became the greatest patrons of art in Europe. They had this unique role. They had a lot of money and they had a lot of willpower and they had a lot of political power as well to get things done. So they were the patrons that every artist wanted to work for.
And I think you label for us, or you list for us in the book and go through for us in the book, 10 different popes that Bernini went through, if we can put it that way, or that some to a lesser or greater extent. But the relationship with Alexander VII seems to have been absolutely the most important. You make a big claim when you say that he was, we're talking about Rubens, Rembrandt, Velázquez, to name but three. You're saying that Bernini outstripped all of these in terms of artistic accomplishment. Who was he before Alexander VII? Who was Bernini?
Well, even as a very, very young person, I mean, he was kind of the Mozart of sculpture. By the time he was 11 or 12 years old, he was being talked about as a very significant sculptor, and he attracted the patronage of extremely important people in Rome. I think it's worth remembering what the papacy was like in the 17th century. You know, today we think of the Pope as a great spiritual and moral and religious leader. In the 17th century, the Pope was also a very considerable political leader. He was a monarch. He was the sovereign of his own state, the papal state. And he commanded tremendous patronage, and successive popes knew how to use the arts, both to inspire people and as propaganda for their own importance and the importance of their own families.
What then is the type of power? You speak about soft power that both Alexander VII and Bernini, that they kind of work together in this respect. What do you mean by that? What exactly is soft power?
Well, soft power, you know, there was someone, I forget which dictator of the 20th century, it might have been Stalin or might have been Hitler, said, how many divisions does the Pope have? Namely, being rather dismissive because the Pope didn't have a big army.
Yeah.
But what the Pope has and had is moral power, influence, cultural power, and that's what soft power is. Soft power is not economic power. It's not military power. It's the power that comes from cultural preeminence. And that's really hugely significant, even in today's world. So everyone is now very interested in soft power. And really, the pioneers of soft power were very much the popes of the 17th century.
Well, who are the equivalents then in today's world? Who are those who are holding the soft power of the cultural world?
Well, you know something, it's all of those countries whose cultural influence punches above their military weight. For example, you know, Ireland has an extremely important role in the world, and part of that importance derives from Irish preeminence in literature, in theatre, in music. These things are really important. Countries like, you know, France has enormous soft power, which is much greater than its economic and political power. The UK is often one of the two or three most important soft power countries in the world. So it's very much a reality. Soft power is what makes people want to visit a country. It's what makes people respect a country. And it's what makes people want to be citizens of a country.
Do you think soft power then is being used by those countries that you've listed off? And I'm glad that you put us in amongst them. Do you think it's been used to its ultimate potential by any of them?
I think it is more widely appreciated. And, you know, for example, there's something a bit like Top of the Pops, which is the annual listing of the soft power league table. And this is very, very important. At a time when countries are competing, soft power is something that can bring incredible competitive advantage to countries that do not have big military industrial complexes. So the importance of soft power and the appreciation of it, I think, is increasing all the time. And we've got to remember that, you know, soft power is ultimately about quality of life. It's about where you want to live. What sort of society do you want to live in? Do you want to live in a place that has wonderful arts and culture? All those things are very, very important. And, you know, one of the sort of products of this current pandemic that we're living through is, I think, a greater appreciation of the things that make life worth living.
That has been echoed by many of the contributors we have had to the programme in recent months. But let me bring us back to the Piazza della Minerva and the young Lloyd Grossman of the 1970s strolling around there. Now, he was a student of history and he was very interested in the history of art, if my facts are correct.
Yeah.
Was he at that point smelling the food around the Palazzo di Minerva,
oh, yes,
or Piazza di Minerva as well?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have been hungry from birth and always interested in food, always interested in food, and always interested in also kind of like the cultural aspect of food, because, you know, food is also, it's about our history, it's about our climate, it's about our aspirations, it's about our cultural values, and food has always fascinated me. And of course, Italy is one of the great food destinations of the world. So certainly, as I was wandering around Rome, as enamored as I was with Baroque power politics, I'm always thinking about the next meal.
And I'm interested in that because the aspect of Italian food versus Baroque architecture that I'm interested in is the simplicity of Italian food and the absolute complexity of any piece of Baroque art that you want to look at.
Yeah, it's a very interesting contradiction, and I'm glad you pointed it out, because, of course, the whole thing about Baroque architecture and art is gosh, how complicated can we make this? And the whole thing about Italian food is, how simple can we make it? And, you know, Italian food is very much about letting the ingredients speak for themselves, not messing around with it, not decorating it with old flowers and stuff like that. And, you know, maybe that is some sort of extraordinary creative tension that exists in Italian culture. You know, on the one hand, the urge to be complicated and crazy, and on the other hand, the deep emotional desire to be really simple and get back to one's roots.
Well, I guess if you're going to tell people to be simple, you'll send them back to one of your earlier books, Lloyd Grossman's Italian Journey. But if you want them to be complex, they can look at the current book. That's Lloyd Grossman speaking to us this evening about his current publication, An Elephant in Rome, Bernini, the Pope and the Making of the Eternal City. It's published by Pallas Athena. Laurel with her latest single, Scream, Drive Faster. J.K. Rowling's private detective Cormoran Strike returns to our TV screens this Sunday evening in Strike Lethal White, which is the third BBC series to be adapted from the novels written under the pen name of Robert Galbraith. Tom Burke plays the title role. Holiday Grainger plays his colleague Robin Ellicott. This time out, they have two cases to investigate that come from very different clients. One, a homeless man so disturbed he can barely function. The other, a wealthy Westminster MP. Declan Burke has been watching the series for us and he's with me in studio. Now, just remind us of who Cormoran Strike is, this Robert Galbraith / J.K. Rowling character. Declan.
Yeah, he first appeared in the novel The Cuckoo's Calling, which was published in 2013, I think. And he's based in London, but he's from Cormwall, original. Cormoran is Cornish, is a Cornish legend. He's a giant in Cornish legend. Cormoran Strike himself, he's ex-British Army, where he served in Afghanistan, where he worked with the SIB, the Special Intelligence. And he lost half his leg in the Afghan conflict, which plays an important part, particularly in the first couple of novels. He is, you know, he's a kind of classic throwback. He's gruff. Mm. He's unrepentantly unreconstructed. He boozes quite a lot. He has issues with authority. Very compelling character, very interesting character, and hugely leavened, I think, by the addition of the character of Robin Ellicott. You suggest she is his colleague, and she is at this point. Initially, she came to him as a temporary secretary.
In fact, the early series, from my memory of it, was as much as anything about the dynamic between the two of them. Not just there's a sexual chemistry thing that we'll come back to later on, but that power dynamic that initially he was, well, you're my assistant, go and do what I tell you, whereas she very much has, she's very close to being level pegging with him, I think. The
oh, absolutely, at this stage. And to be fair to Cormoran Strike, he was quite protective and he simply didn't want, he's old fashioned, he didn't want to put the lady into the dangerous situation. Yeah. That was his approach. But as you say, you know, she's very psychologically acute. She wanted to join the police originally and couldn't as a result of a brutal attack she suffered at college. But absolutely, she's on par with him now as a colleague.
In fact, this series opens with her wedding.
Yes,
and there's been a long-standing will they, won't they, both in terms of the wedding and in terms of Robin Ellicott and Cormoran Strike.
Yeah, that tension, as you suggested, has been there since the start, really, of the series of novels, and Lethal White is based on the fourth novel. Cormoran turns up to Robin's wedding. He has been, he's worse for the wear. He's badly beaten and bruised and so forth, and hardly able to stand. And at the wedding, Robin discovers that her husband, who's Matthew, has been trying to block Cormoran from her life, and she discovers that he's too late, that he's controlling and manipulative and so forth. But there's an obvious, you know, right from the start, as you say, there's that tension. It hasn't dissipated due to her getting married, let's put it that
and
way.
And I'd say there were more than one people shouting at the screen when she went ahead with the marriage. Stop now!
Yes, yes, indeed.
She didn't, but I guess that's part of what will get us through another few series. Let's have a listen to a clip from the current series then. And this is, I mentioned two cases that there are. Here's the first of those cases. A young homeless man played here by Joseph Quinn. And he comes into the office of Cormoran and Robin, and this is the story he tells.
I seen a girl strangled. They strangled her up there.
My name's Cormoran Strike. Do you want to
Don't
sit down?
Don't ask me things! Just... I shouldn't even be talking. Just listen, okay? The girl I saw killed, she's in the dell behind my dad's cottage. He helped them bury her there. I can't go.
I'd like to help you, but please don't hurt yourself. You can tell me anything, okay? We'll look after you.
They buried her in a pink blanket. They didn't know I seen them, but I did, and they buried her.
That's Joseph Quinn there as Billy Knight. You also heard the voice of Tom Burke as Cormoran Strike in the new series of Strike Lethal White, which starts on BBC television this Sunday. Declan Burke has been looking at the first few episodes for us. It's a very disturbing story, as it's certainly, I only saw the beginning, the early part of this episode. It struck me that this is difficult subjects, but they haven't shied away from that in the past in the stories.
No, they haven't, and that clip actually sums up, and the disturbing is the word I would have used as well. And what adds to another kind of disturbing element is that the young man Billy Knight is, you know, he's visibly and audibly traumatized. Mm. You know, can Cormoran Strike take his, you know, is he telling the truth? Is it a delusion that this man is suffering? Is it a hallucination? And it's one of the most likable aspects of Strike, because he's this old fashioned throwback. He's a knight errant and he can take on this case. He's not going to be paid by Billy Knight, who seems to be homeless and so forth, but he believes him. There's a couple of small details. The pink blanket, for example, is a detail that leaps out for Cormoran Strike. So he believes in the truth of what Billy Knight is saying.
I think his line is that he's been so specific about what he's telling us here, he's not making it up. But we do get a sense, even in that clip, of the nature of the way that Tom Burke portrays Cormoran Strike. You totally trust him. But there's a kind of a moody thing going on as well, isn't there?
There is. I mean, in the clip, the character of Cormoran Strike and the way Tom Burke plays him, you know, put it down, I don't want you to hurt yourself. So what we don't realise from the audio is that young Billy Knight is holding a knife and is actually covered in blood. So in theory, Cormoran Strike should be fearing for himself because he's been confronted in his office by a psychotic young man bearing a knife. But he's concerned for the young man. And not only that, he's prepared to go beyond the immediacy of the danger to try and get to the heart of what it is that has brought the young man so desperately to his office. So, yeah, there's something quite gruff, and I use the word unreconstructed, and he's deliberately portrayed that way. Now, the character in the series is slightly less curmudgeonly, can I put it that way, than he is in the novels. Right. But yeah, Tom Burke conveys this great sense of calm. He's, you know, a kind of a man's man, but he's sensitive. He's bluntly spoken, but he's quite thoughtful in the way he goes about his business. And it's a very nice blend. It's a very beguiling blend to watch.
But in the mix also is the Robin Ellicott character played by Holiday Granger. I think you were saying to me just as we were coming to air that from what you've seen so far, it seems the story seems to be going to a lot more now towards her background and her backstory.
Well, I personally find her the more interesting character than Cormoran Strike. The wedding you mentioned, we leap forward a year after the events of that wedding.
Which is what opens this series.
This story opens properly. And we realise that we see Robin in therapy, for example. She's having severe anxiety, episodes of panic attacks and so forth. And she's living a double life because we see that she's been emotionally and possibly even physically bullied at home, whereas in public then and at work, she has to convey this impression of being, you know, composed and calm and on top of her business. And actually, she is. Professionally, she's brilliant at her job. Unfortunately, her job then requires her to go undercover at Westminster, which incorporates the second part of the plot. But that's another layer of pressure that's put on her to, you know, she's not just living this double life. She has to, you know, pretend to be somebody else in the second part of this double act. And that's a lot for the character to take on board, also a lot for Granger Holiday to take
on
board.
Holiday Granger,
excuse me. And I think she does a superb job, manages to convey the kind of the real intense pressure that she's experiencing privately and yet exude this kind of composure and calmness in public.
All right, well, let's have a listen to a second clip, and this will give us a sense of that second plot layer, if you like, which I presume they'll all knit into each other somehow further down the line, but that's the job of the writer. And that's how they keep us hooked. So it's a politician speaking to Cormoran here. The politician is Jasper Chiswell, played by Robert Glenister.
I'm being blackmailed by two men. I haven't paid them anything yet. I assumed it would only encourage them.
That's often how it goes. Have you gone to the police?
No, and I shan't be doing that. It only takes one bent copper to flog it to a newspaper. And besides, one of the men is intent on destroying me. I doubt he'd be deterred.
What are they blackmailing you over?
My conscience is clear. That's all you need to know about that. I thought it'd be fine, but apparently now there are pictures. And once they get hold of those, I need something I can use against them. The threat of an eye for an eye, do you see? So that everybody has something to lose.
So who are the two men?
Geraint Wynne. He runs the office for his wife, Della, the MP.
She's blind, isn't she? She's done some work with veterans.
Never bloody shuts up about it. Listening to her, you'd think that playing a game with a full set of limbs is a kind of cheating. The other man's a very different fish. He's hard left. One of those people who's against everything. His name's Jimmy Knight.
There you go. Robert Glenister there as the MP who's been blackmailed in the new series of Strike, Lethal White, which Declan Burke is speaking to us about this evening. You know, when I started watching Glenister in the part there, I thought, ah, yeah, fair enough. OK, he's been blackmailed and his conscience is clear. 3 seconds later, he's saying, I want an eye for an eye. Get some dirt on them so that I can dish it back at them. Does it become more complex as the things progress?
The storyline, yes, it does. I'm delighted to report the character of Jasper Chisel doesn't really. I found him one of the disappointing aspects of not just the novel, but also this adaptation. He is a bit one-dimensional, Sean.
Now, just in terms of, because I wondered this, you know, Robert Galbraith wrote Cuckoo's Nest, The Cuckoo's Calling. And we all, I think we remember the story. Nobody knew much about The Cuckoo's Calling until ka-donk, somebody dropped that Robert Galbraith was in fact J.K. Rowling. Do you think Robert Galbraith would have had the success in the TV series?
Probably not, is the short answer. Now, having said that, I mean, J.K. Rowling, she wrote this under a pseudonym, according to her, you know, her own story, because of the runaway success, of course, of Harry Potter. She wanted to write something new, fresh, and she loved the crime genre, to get completely unfiltered reaction and so forth. The early reaction from, we'll say, her peers, I mean, for example, Val McDermott was one of the early readers she had been sent, etc., and she was raving about it, and she had already booked this Robert Galbraith for a kind of a debutante author at the, I think it was the Bristol Crime Festival.
Yeah, and this was before anybody knew that it was J.K. Rowling.
Before any of that. So the feedback for the novel was very solid. Now, it was published, I think, a couple of weeks before the news dropped about J.K. Rowling, and it had sold something like 1,200 copies in hardback, which is not remarkable. But it's, you know, it's nothing to be sneezed at too. 1,200 copies in a couple of weeks in hardback. So I know is
how many
a short
did it
answer.
Sell? Do you have a quick answer to how many did it sell subsequently?
I don't. I would suggest it's in the hundreds of thousands rather than the thousands. So possibly not a TV series. I think it would have done well and been very well reviewed. Would we be sitting here in this studio talking about the fifth novel, which is upcoming in September? I don't.
And what has she achieved then, both Robert Galbraith, J.K. Rowling? What has she achieved across the series of books? You say novel number five is on the way. The Lethal White is novel number four, the one in this series is based on, isn't
that's
it?
That's right. The Troubled Blood is the fifth one, which is coming next month. I don't think she's reinvented the wheel with the Strike novels, Sean, to be honest. I think, yes, it's a nice kind of throwback to it's a homage to the older private eye genre, the private eye genre had kind of completely, or not completely, but had more or less fallen out of fashion. It wasn't a thing you could do anymore, largely because of the way technology has caught up and has taken a lot of the romance out of the genre. So she's kind of rebooted the private eye, particularly here over in the UK, I should say, on this side of the pond. So yeah, hasn't reinvented the wheel, but has given us really good storytelling, two interesting characters who I think have had the luck of being played by two very good actors they've returned for this series as well.
In terms of where this new series is going, I'm thinking of that noir world that we might think of for the private eye. They have this kind of seedy office, but we're not in a seedy world, really, are we?
No, and that's one of my favourite things about this, actually, because Susan Tully, who directs the episode one, and Alison Riva, who's a production designer, very beautifully observed. So we're in contemporary London. That's the setting. So we do get, you know, the bright and shiny streets, and there's Pret-a-Manger and all the usual landmarks we might, you know, expect. And then when the story goes into the interiors, we're into this very dimliness and shabby office, as you say, and it's kind of claustrophobic, and we're back in the smoke-filled rooms of the old private eyes. And even when they go to the pub, it's always these kind of classic London pubs, very low ceilings and, you know, very dark rafters and so forth. Part of the story takes place at Westminster. So when Robin Ellicott arrives first, you know, it's into the beautifully, you know, the vaulted ceilings, a very airy space. And then she's shuttled upstairs into these tight little cubbyhole offices where all the backstabbing and so forth goes on. So it's a lovely little blend, the kind of the old and new coming together, and visually detailed as well. Very
so
well done.
So worth watching. And will those who want more of the will they, won't they storyline to continue, will that continue?
That will probably continue ad nauseum, Sean, because, you know, it only works as long as they are still will they or won't they ing. I don't know if that's a verb or not, but there you go.
And as somebody corrected me recently when I said, are you going to do that ad nauseum? They said, well, perhaps ad infinitum, hopefully not ad nauseum. Okay, so you recommend we watch it?
Very solid entertainment, and anyone who's watched the previous ones will, yeah, absolutely.
All right, the book was brilliant, says Rosie in a text into us here. Can't wait for the drama. Both actors equally brilliant, and I think you're echoing that, Declan Barkley. First episode of Strike Lethal White will be broadcast on BBC One 9 p.m. Sunday, August the 30th. The second episode then goes out on Monday, August 31st. Kay Tempest, formerly known as Kate Tempest, is a musician and performance poet from England, established now as one of the most cutting-edge artists of their kind. Since releasing a debut studio album, Balance, in 2011, Tempest has published 5 poetry collections, written 3 plays, 1 novel, and added 3 further albums to an acclaimed discography. But to answer the question, where do I begin with in relation to Kay Tempest, I'm joined now on the line by one of their many Irish fans, Una Mullally. And let's start with the fact that it's no longer Kate Tempest, but Kay Tempest. And it's more than just a name change that is involved here, Una.
Yeah, so earlier this month, Kay Tempest posted a note to their Twitter account saying that they were changing their name from Kate to Kay, and also their pronouns. And they said, quote, I've been struggling to accept myself as I am for a long time. I've tried to be what I thought others wanted me to be so as not to risk rejection. This hiding from myself has led to all kinds of difficulties in my life. And this is the first step towards knowing and respecting myself better. So there you go.
Yeah. So from now on, we refer to the artist as Kay, and the pronouns they and their are what should apply. When then did you first come across Kay Tempest?
I think I'd probably read about them before I read them, if you know what I mean, probably close to a decade ago. And then particularly around the release of Brand New Ancients, which is a poem, a theatre production, and then a book. And that won the Ted Hughes Award. And then I think they were named like a next generation poet by the Poetry Book Society, which is like awarded only once a decade or something. So I think at that point, it's really clear that here's a young artist emerging out of London who is kind of beyond special. Singular, I think, is maybe a way, and just like very, very astute understanding of contemporary British life in a way that is romantic in its grittiness, but doesn't shy away from kind of the decline of British society and neoliberalism and all that kind of stuff.
Well, how romantic then was that upbringing, or how gritty was that upbringing, or was it in fact both, as you suggest, in terms of how they express their music and their poetry expresses that upbringing?
Yeah, very much embedded in city life, I guess. They're from Southeast London, Brockley, which is in Lewisham. Study at the Brit School, which tends to be quite a mainstream pipeline for contemporary artists, and read English literature at Goldsmiths. And then kind of started performing poetry in different hip hop venues, doing open mic nights and that kind of thing. Very much rooted in spoken words, and then kind of occupying that space between hip hop and polemic. They're in a band, Sound of Rum, started writing plays. And then recording albums with Dan Carey, who produced the first 2 Fontaines DC albums, actually. Mm. And then when I first saw them live was at Glastonbury. They used to do this set on Thursday nights at a little venue called the Rum Shack. And that was really kind of beginning to understand, wow, the potency of the performance, you know, this very kind of petite, you know, curly haired blonde Londoner just owning the stage with this very abrasive musical score and saying this kind of stuff that really a lot of other artists just weren't really saying.
Yeah, I remember similarly seeing them in Kilkenny I can't remember the year, but in the Set Theatre, and it was an incredible set that they did on that night in that theatre. You couldn't leave the place Yeah, it was totally and absolutely riveting. Now, the first piece that you're suggesting we should start with, Una, is Martial Law. And this comes from the 2014 Mercury-nominated album Everybody Down. Tell us why this particular piece. What is it about Martial Law that's particularly important or maybe gives us a way into Kay Tempest?
I think it's a really good introductory track. Like, it's part of how the album starts out. Like most of their work, it's kind of like a concept album. It's the beginning of a story. You're becoming immersed in this character called Becky, and it kind of sets the scene of the world that Becky inhabits with incredible detail. So it's a good place to start.
If I'm being honest, well, it is, it's like a trap. I ain't trying to be flash, I just need to raise the cash for the dream. I hardly touch it myself, like it ain't that. But once I set myself a task, well, there ain't no going back. And I am halfway there, I am nearly. Anyway, the point is, I kinda had to push all of my friends away. I can't have nobody knowing what I'm up to. I keep it very secret, but the thing is, I would love to, just for one day, you know, live like any other guy. I can't have a girlfriend, you see, cause I don't like to lie. It's safer all round that I just keep my head down.
Martial Law there from Kay Tempest and the 2014 Mercury nominated album Everybody Down. Una Mullally is helping us answer the question, where do I start with Kay Tempest this evening? It's extraordinary when you listen to that. It's theatrical, it's musical, and it has the power of spoken word. And you say, oh, I've heard that a million times. Yeah, but you've heard people copying Kay Tempest, I would hazard you would might say, Una.
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, their work is very lyrically dense and it can be quite abrasive. Like, it can almost be difficult to enter because there's so much going on. And I think as well, like, spoken word is kind of a term that I think a lot of people who start out speaking poems out loud end up rejecting in some way because the cadences and form can become a little cliche. But, you know, it's hard not to see that influence of slam poetry, like the more American slam poetry and Tempest early spoken word stuff flowing into her quote unquote rap or music, you know, very descriptive, very earnest, lots of social commentary, almost kind of hyperbolic in a way. And it's really like hitting you, you know, it doesn't allow you a path in. It just kind of smacks you straight away.
It kind of, it strikes me, it does something more than hip hop. It does something more than, and I take your point about the term spoken word in some ways is kind of reductive, but it does more than a piece of poetry might be able to do. The music and the words kind of add up to something bigger than the sum of the parts.
Yeah, because that energy, like, you can really feel the kind of the drizzle on the taxi, you know, window and the darkness of a night out. It's so immersive and, you know, cinematic and also novelistic at the same time, which is kind of a weird mix to be able to pull off. But you're definitely there, you know, and there's a lot of stuff about Tempest stuff that's very much about place. It's like, come here now and sit here and watch what's going on.
Well, even as I was listening to the closing lines there of Martial Law, I was kind of, I thought, I'm almost in a Marco Rowe, Howie the Rookie world. You know, it was as immediate as standing in the theatre, listening to a story like that being told to you.
Yeah, and I think that there's a bunch of different influences, like from theatre, from cinema, that come in. You know, I often think about Ken Loach, about Shane Meadows, Andre Arnold, you know, John Cooper Clarke, you know, even Bernardino Evaristo, you know, that just this sequence of people that you're meeting and willing you to exist in the place that they're bringing you to. It's a plunge pool, really, of their music.
Let's move on then to the second piece that you're suggesting, Una, would help us into the world of Kay Tempest from the 2016 album Let Them Eat Chaos, Europe Is Lost. And that title, both the album title Let Them Eat Chaos and the track title Europe Is Lost, gives us a sense of where we are in British history.
Yeah, definitely. This is like the most, or one of the most overtly political or even geopolitical tracks. And again, you know, it is quite bleak. And in order, I think, to gain the most out of Tempest music, you need to kind of listen to the bleakness, because it often gives way to hope, you know. And this is, again, it's about England. It's about capitalism. It's about the mess we find ourselves in. And it's about the trauma of neoliberalism and the nihilism of that as well. So that's always an anchor or a millstone, really, around a lot of the music.
So, as we said, the track is Europe Is Lost. The album is Let Them Eat Chaos from Kay Tempest's 2016 album.
Your Europe is lost, America lost, London lost. Still we are clamouring victory. All that is meaningless rules. We have learnt nothing from history. The people are dead in their lifetimes, dazed in the shine of the streets. But look how the traffic's still moving. System's too slick to stop working. Business is good and there's bands every night in the pubs. And there's 2-for-1 drinks in the clubs. And we scrubbed up well, washed off the work and the stress. And now all we want some excess. Better yet, a night to remember that we'll soon forget.
There we go, Kate Tempest with the track Europe is Lost, and that from the 2016 album Let Them Eat. Kay Asuna Mullally helping us to answer the question, where do I start or where do I begin with Kay Tempest? The same year as that album came the novel The Bricks That Build the Houses. Tell me a little bit about that book.
Yeah, it's a really good novel, you know, and like a lot of Tempest stuff, it's about interlocking lives, colliding lives. It's about, you know, Becky, the character, is kind of here again, and it's about the story of people kind of running from their lives, trying to get out of the drudgery, the poverty, the danger, violence of Southeast London. And again, this kind of clash of serendipity and coincidences that Kay Tempest often plays with regards to how people end up where they are and who they meet along the way. And again, London, very, very central to this kind of thing, and a fading London, you know, a part of London that has not yet been gentrified and still holds a kind of a visceral danger.
I want to finish up with the Book of Traps and Lessons, and in fact, a track called People's Face that I know you believe to be Tempest's among their greatest work. But what are you expecting now? Are you very excited about what might come as a result of this change in name and this acknowledgement of their gender identity?
Yeah, I think for me, like, Kay Tempest is always one of these artists who feels quite prophetic. I certainly feel this about their last record, which was released last year, and the tour that accompanied it, which I saw live twice. Willing people to let go of technology, even in the room. You know, staring towards a horizon and guiding people almost towards something else. And it's her most minimalist work. Mm. It's their most clear work. And, you know, it offers an awful lot of hope. I know that some of the tracks that we played sound a little grim or whatever, but there's so much hope in this. And actually, they have a new book coming out called On Connection in October of this year. So I'm really excited about that.
People's Faces, or People's, is it Faces? Or, yeah, it is People's Faces, plural. Why this particular track? What makes it for you among the top end of their work?
I think it's very difficult to write something that is about humanity and empathy without sounding corny. And I think they really achieve it with this, that within all of the struggle and all of the hardship and all of the existential worry, that if there is a capacity for empathy and a moment for people to come together, then we'll get through it. I've listened to this a lot, actually, this year, given the circumstances that we're in.
Yeah, well, listen, thanks for sharing your thoughts on it with us this evening, Una. That's Una Mullally there, speaking to us about performance poet, playwright and novelist Kay Tempest. And let's have a listen to People's Faces.
It's coming to pass. My country's coming apart. The whole thing's becoming such a bumbling farce. Was that a pivotal historical moment we just went stumbling past? Well, here we are, dancing in the rumbling dark. So come a little closer, give me something to grasp. Give me your beautiful, crumbling heart. I saw it roaring.
And that's People's Faces. Beautiful, just the simplicity of that over the piano, the accompanying piano. Kay Tempest there, and that's from their latest album, The Book of Traps and Lessons, album from 2019. Una Mullally sharing her thoughts on the work of Kay Tempest with us on this Monday evening and bringing us to the end of this evening's programme. Tomorrow we will share Dearin the Grafer with you when she's bringing together the story of an 18th century noble woman and a young mother in contemporary Ireland. That's in her new book, Ghost in the Throat. We'll also be celebrating 30 years since the first production of Dancing at Lunasa. Can you believe that? But that is our lot for this evening. Paula Shields and Liam Murphy researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Pather Carney was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RTÉ Radio 1.